I'll be reading from Mark 12, verses 18 through 27. Then the Sadducees said, "Who say there is no resurrection?" came to him with a question. "Teacher," they said, "Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife, but no children, the man must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married and died without leaving any children. The second one married the widow, but he also died leaving no child. It was the same with the third. In fact, none of the seven left any children. Last of all, the woman died too. At the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since the seven were married to her?" Jesus replied, "Are you not in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God? When the dead rise, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Now about the dead rising, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the account of the burning bush, how God said to him, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are badly mistaken.'"
Good morning. How many of you, I don't want to rush into this. How many of you, work with this guy? You work with this guy? He thinks he's always right. Now, 2 years ago, I think he's the same guy that was arrogant in my sermon illustration. But today, he's the guy that thinks he's always right. Do you know somebody who thinks they're always right? Are you sitting by him? Hey, guys, don't raise your hand. Well, could you be him? Could that be us? How many of you could be wrong about something? Raise your hand. Okay. All right. Now, raise your hand as soon as you can think of a specific example of something you might be wrong about. Okay. Hands go up a little slower on that one. It's easy for me to admit in theory that I could be wrong. It's just hard to think of a specific example. You know, it's kind of how that goes. But I ask that because I think this passage is a lot about being wrong. The first thing out of Jesus' mouth is, "Are you not in error?" in verse 24. And the last thing he says in verse 27 is, "You are badly mistaken." I think there's some emphasis in this passage on being wrong. Now, there's some other good stuff in here, too, that I'd like to talk about, but we're just going to focus on the possibility that you could be wrong. Aren't you glad you came today? I've got a special gift of encouragement, and I just thought I'd share with you, for your encouragement, that you could be wrong. Actually, it is something that we need to know. And don't forget, I'm talking about you. I can distinctly remember reading this passage and thinking, "Those Sadducees, how could they be so stupid? They're wrong." And then I thought, oh, wait, the Bible's supposed to still apply today. And so I thought to myself, those Methodists, you know, we always think of somebody else, right? Well, I'm pretty sure we need to be thinking not about the Methodists, not about the Sadducees, not about our spouse, not about our roommate, not about that guy at work, but about me, that I could be wrong. And even though that's not particularly encouraging, it is particularly important. The Proverbs say there is a way that appears to be right, but in the end, it leads to death. Sometimes we make fatal mistakes. And I'm thinking spiritually here. That's my real concern. And I don't think God is a drill instructor walking around with a magnifying glass hoping to find us off slightly on some minor point so he can throw us out of heaven. That's not who God is, as best as I can tell. But at the same time, it does matter what we think and what we believe and what we act on. The Bible has this thing called sound doctrine. And I've told you before, I grew up hearing that phrase in a way that kind of took on a life of its own. I never realized that sound means healthy and doctrine means teaching. So sound doctrine is healthy teaching. There are some teachings and ideas and beliefs and doctrines that are healthy, that are good for us, and there are some that are not healthy, that are bad for us, and that can even bring us to ruin. So it does matter whether we're right or wrong. And I believe we're going to do a whole lot better if we fess up actually to the possibility that we could be wrong. Now, I can only think of about 90 gajillion ways that we could be wrong, but I've decided to limit it to three, and I'll focus on three that grow out of this text. Three ways we can be wrong that are kind of like the ways the Sadducees were wrong. And the first one is, we can be wrong about the Scriptures if we do not accept them in their entirety. The Sadducees lived in the first century, and at that time, the Scriptures consisted of the entire, what we call, Old Testament. It was kind of organized differently, but same material as the Old Testament. But they only accepted the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And so I think that's kind of where I get this point. You can be wrong if you don't accept the Scriptures in their entirety. And in fact, in the Old Testament, the resurrection is taught more clearly after those first five books. Now, it's in the first five books too, as Jesus pointed out to them, but it's clearer after that, and that may be one of the reasons that they missed it. So same thing for us. If we don't accept the Bible in its entirety, it's going to be really easy for us to be wrong about some things. Now, how many of you accept the Bible in its entirety? This is hand-raising day. Okay? Okay. I can wait as long as you. You're supposed to raise your hand on this one. Okay? Well, for a lot of years, Churches of Christ and some other groups have been accused of not accepting the Old Testament. And, to be fair, we do not live under the covenant that God made with Moses and the people on Mount Sinai in the Old Testament. We don't live under that covenant. But that doesn't mean we don't believe in the Old Testament. The New Testament several times endorses the Old Testament and says we're supposed to use it. For example, in 2 Timothy 3, we read, all Scripture is inspired by God and is profitable or useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, training in righteousness. And the specific Scripture that that is talking about is the Old Testament. There was no New Testament when Paul wrote that in the New Testament, right? So it's endorsing the value of the Old Testament. Yeah, you don't live under that covenant, but you learn a lot from it. I'll give you another example. When I was growing up, there was a terrible tendency to focus on Acts through Jude. We didn't do Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John much. Those are the kids' stories. do those in kids' classes was kind of the thinking. We didn't know how to handle narrative material very well. And we sure didn't know how to handle Revelation. And I distinctly remember somebody was pointing that out, and I looked at the edge of my Bible, and sure enough, the pages from Acts to Jude were dirty, and the rest of them were white. At least I was reading something, but I was very selective. I wasn't accepting the scriptures in their entirety. Today, I feel like that could go the other direction. Some people today are really open to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and what Jesus did and said, but they're not so big on what Paul said. And it's kind of ironic that they will accept the words of Christ, but not the words inspired by the Spirit of Christ. Gotta accept the scriptures in their entirety. But maybe the biggest way we violate this is just the buffet style. We read through and we take what we like and we quickly pass over the parts we don't like. Those are the vegetables, you know. There's teachings that challenge us or confront us or point out our sin or our self-centeredness, or they say things that we just don't get or things that don't really seem to fit the world today. And we just kind of pass over those. Well, I understand that. There's some hard things in there. But I still believe we have to accept the entirety of Scripture. And if we don't, we're going to be wrong about some things. Another way we can be wrong is to have a settled view on some matter. And I understand you're supposed to have some settled views. I'll get to that side of it in a minute. But right here, what I'm thinking is, in verse 18, when the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to Jesus with a question, they had a settled view that there is no resurrection. And that settled view got them in trouble. It made them wrong. And it's all the more dangerous to have a settled view if you get your identity wrapped up in that view. If you think Sadducees, you think, oh, that's the people that don't believe in resurrection. That was their identity. And sometimes we've had our identity in some settled view on something. Churches of Christ, those are the people that don't believe in instrumental music. Or applying it to yourself as an individual. I'm a conservative Christian. I'm a progressive Christian. I'm an egalitarian Christian. I'm a Bible-oriented Christian. I'm a works-oriented Christian. I'm a grace-oriented. We get our identity invested in a settled view on something, and we're setting ourselves up for trouble. Our settled view is our synthesis of the scriptures, but it's not the scriptures. It's the way we've put it together, and that makes sense to us, but it's different from the scriptures themselves. And what we'll do so often is I get my settled view of something, and then I read something that doesn't really fit my view, and I just pass over it. Kind of like the first point, not accepting that because it doesn't fit my settled view. This leads to another matter that I want to talk about a little bit, and that is, have you ever heard of motivated reasoning? Motivated reasoning is a way that we go astray in how we think about things. We like to think we're so logical and we just look at the evidence and decide based on evidence and logic. And so when we come to the scriptures, we'd like to think, well, my view is just based on what the scripture says. Well, motivated reasoning means your reasoning is flawed by your motivations. Here's the best example of it. Back in the 50s, they did a study. This was before I was alive, because it was the early 50s. Okay. And it was a study of sports people watching sports, and they notice that if the refs make a call that go against your team, you're real likely to believe that was a bad call. But if they make a call that goes for your team, you're real likely to think that was a good call. And I've experienced that. How many of you have experienced that? Still hand-raising day. I have a friend, some of y'all know, Stan Goodson. He's a pretty good guy. He has a couple of flaws. One is he's a Dallas Cowboys fan. Some of you have that same flaw. And see, I lived in Philadelphia 12 years. But our friendship was strong enough that we could watch the Eagles-Cowboys game together. And I distinctly remember probably 10 years ago, we're watching a game together, and there's a call that favors the Eagles. And Stan just griped and complained about that call. And I thought, he's so biased. He's such a Cowboys fan, he can't even see. That was a good call. And it didn't even dawn on me until this past week that I was falling prey to that study. I was biased too. That's why I was so sure he was biased. Is you favor what favors your team. Another example of this, I'll explain. It's a little complicated. It's in your notes. You can Google this if you want to read the article. But this Yale professor did a study, and he made up all the data. You know, that's how you do studies. But he made up the data because that's not what he was really studying. He was studying the way our motives affect our ability to reason. And he made up this skin rash, and he said, these people took skin cream X, and this many of them got better, and this many of them got worse. And these people did not take skin cream X, and this many of them got better, and this many of them got worse. And he said, just look at those four numbers and do the math and decide, does this data support the fact that skin cream X makes you better, or that skin cream X makes you worse? And if you're kind of a math person and you bust out your phone and do the calculations, you can figure which way the data supports that. Doesn't really matter because the data was all made up. Okay? Now, then he took that same, that's the control group, took the very same four numbers and plugged it into the real test and applied it to concealed handguns. And he said, these cities have a law against concealed handguns. And in this many cities, crime went up. In this many cities, crime went down. These cities did not have any such law. In this city, crime went up. In this city, crime went down. And then he asked the same question. Does the data support that this law against concealed handguns increases crime or decreases crime? And suddenly, nobody could do math. They couldn't reason anymore because their politics got in the way. And he had asked them about their politics beforehand, and their math skills for that matter. But they ceased to be able to do math. They couldn't reason because of what they wanted the answer to be. Guess which political party was worse about that? I looked at the numbers and I made a totally unbiased investigation, and I've concluded that the other party is the problem. Right? It's always the other party. No, actually both were equally bad. Republicans and Democrats both did the same thing. And the reason that's important is because when we get a settled view on something in Scripture, it's going to be really difficult to see anything different from the view that we've settled on. And don't forget that a lot of heresy, a lot of false teaching, unhealthy teaching, is a matter of extreme. The Bible teaches grace. The Bible teaches obedience. And if you get all extreme and have a settled view of grace that leaves obedience out, you're going to be out of balance, and it's going to be unhealthy teaching. And if you go all the way down here and focus all on obedience and neglect grace and have a settled view focused on obedience, you're going to be out of balance, and it's going to be unhealthy teaching. So what I'm thinking when you put these two points together is, if I'm reading the Bible and I come across something that doesn't fit my settled view, instead of reading quickly, I need to slow down and listen and pray and chew on that verse that doesn't seem to fit my settled view. The Bible can take care of itself. Our synthesis can be wrong. And when we have a strongly held, settled view on something, we're susceptible to not hearing what the rest of Scripture has to say. One other matter is not knowing the power of God. Jesus said, "Are you not in error because you do not know the Scriptures, do not know the power of God?" And I'm connecting this especially to their little story. They told Jesus a story. There were these seven brothers, and they all got married. And how many of you think that was a real story? Think that's a real story or a made up story? How many of you don't think at all? I think it's a made up story. I think once you get down to about the third or fourth time, you don't keep marrying them. Yeah, that's what I think. But anyway, they come up with this story. Maybe it was real. Maybe they made it up. And they think that this proves conclusively that there's no resurrection. And they tell it to Jesus. And basically they say, "There, what are you going to do with that? It proves we're right." And Jesus says, "You're in error. You don't know the Scriptures, and you don't know the power of God." And it got me to thinking, there's probably a lot of times when we are susceptible to neglecting how God's power makes something possible, but maybe we are especially susceptible to that when we start coming up with little theoretical examples. When we break out our logic, or we break out our anecdote, or our story, or our example, it may be that that's a time we really need to be on our toes and make sure that we are not negating the power of God. Because God can take care of all of that. God can take care of their little story, and He can take care of whatever objection you come up with as well, or me. And so if we're wanting to undermine something in the Bible because it doesn't sit too well with us, and we say, "Well, what about this kind of case?" Blah, 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 blah. God can take care of that. We don't have to be able to understand it for God to be able to take care of it. Or your friend, your brother, your sister says, "Well, I believe this. Here's my settled view." And we don't like their settled view. And so we say, "Well, what about this kind of an illustration or logic or example?" God can take care of those. Now, I don't want to be naive, but neither do I want to think that I've got it figured out better than God does. And we always need to bring God's power in. And there's much about God that we don't understand. And I think we need to acknowledge that, so that we're at least wrong less often. Now, here's a problem. These are social rules. You may want to jot these down. Don't judge anybody. You ever heard that in our society? Don't offend anybody. And don't hurt anybody's feelings. Now, these are rules that people live by. Seems like they violate them plenty. And good luck with that second one, not offending anybody. But you know, we hear these rules, and I think it makes us tentative. I think it makes us hesitant to come to settled views. Because my settled view might offend somebody, or somebody might think I'm judging them, or it might hurt somebody's feelings. And so I'm not going to come to settled view, or if I do, I'm sure not going to say it, not out loud. I think these rules in society make us a little tentative. And then some preacher comes along and says, and on top of that, you could be wrong anyway. You know, we're already hesitant to talk about stuff. And now Marvin is saying, or maybe the Bible is saying, you could be wrong. And I just think that tends to make us tentative. And we're afraid to speak. And we're afraid to say what we think. And we're afraid to act according to our beliefs. So what do you do with that? What do you do with, you don't want to be judgmental and you don't want to offend and you really could be wrong, but at the same time, God does want us to speak, right? He does want us to act on what we've heard from Him. So what do you do with that? And I think a healthy way of looking at it is we do speak and we do act, but we do so humbly, not defiantly, not so adamantly that we can never be wrong about anything, but we speak humbly. Remember, there's more for us to learn, right? We don't understand it all now. And Jesus says in Matthew 11, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth. You've hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. If we want to keep learning, we've got to have the heart of little children and have the humility to acknowledge that we could be wrong. And if we will couple that attitude of humility by doing the opposite of what the Sadducees did, that is reading all the scriptures, pausing on the passages that don't fit in well with our current views, honestly believing God is powerful enough to do anything, if we'll do that as well as have an attitude of humility, I think that'll go a long way to preventing us from being wrong. It's not like we'll never be wrong again, but we won't be wrong as much, and we'll keep growing, and we'll be wrong less. Our world is full of people. In fact, our church right here, there's plenty of people here and out there who are building their lives on all kinds of wrong ideas, unhealthy ideas, ruinous ideas. We need people who will go to God humbly and learn healthy ideas and build their lives on those ideas and then share them with other people. And I think we got a better chance of doing that if we remember we can be wrong. So if you want to talk about one of those or about anything else going on with you or pray, we'll have some of our shepherds and their wives at the back, and you can catch one of them now while we stand and sing together.